Hello and welcome to Art Monthly's radio show. I'm Chris McCormack and today I'm joined by Jamie Sutcliffe, who is a writer and publisher with Strange Attractor Press, Naomi Pierce, who is a writer and co-founder of Woodmill. Jamie and Naomi launched their copy of the journal AOist on the weekend, which is available on Eros Press website, and Adam Pugh, who is a writer, curator and designer based in Norwich. Adam will be discussing the second Oberhausen Film Festival that took place at the beginning of May. Naomi will be talking about Martin Sims' work, which is just still on display at the ICA Gallery in London. But first, we're starting with Jamie Sutcliffe and his feature, Space Wars. This text looks at the limits, costs and possible freedoms available in the digital world. I wondered if we could begin with the title itself, Space Wars, and what this actually refers to.
So Space Wars refers to something very specific, and that's a video game that was created in the labs at MIT in 1962, mm-hmm. a very kind of primitive video game simulation of intergalactic conflict. But the reason that I bring it up is because there's a kind of specific moment in the history of what we kind of have come to understand as the contemporary user, in which this video game was used to demonstrate a specific form of computational labor. Mm-hmm. And this kind of, my knowledge of this emerged from a book that was written by a network engineer called Tung Hui Hu, who I interviewed for Rhizome at the end of last year. And he kind of goes into this incredible backstory of how the user isn't necessarily something natural. I mean, we all kind of take it for granted now because it's something so sort of attuned to the way that we use things habitually, like our smartphones, tablets, and laptops. Yeah. But the user is something incredibly synthetic, and it's produced through a specific, I guess, sort of distribution of labor. And I guess the thing that really interested me in terms of this kind of backstory was the way that what we kind of have come to understand as a certain kind of entitlement to online space is underscored by something that's incredibly kind of contrived and conceited towards a certain rendition of like performativity and a performativity of the self.
Yeah, absolutely. And you talk a little bit about that in relation to numerous sort of artworks as well. One being Larry Achiampong and David Blandy, which is sort of was made sort of using gaming technology. Is that right?
Yeah, totally. So the thing that really kind of animated the article for me was basically going to this kind of event at Toynbee Studios that Larry and David had put together. And it's like very generally just kind of orchestrated to discuss this relationship between post-humanism and the post-colonial. Yeah. And there are all sorts of films on show there, but the one that really kind of stood out to me was their own film, which is called Finding Fanon 2. And it's part of an ongoing series. But the thing that really kind of got me about this one is that it's made using a video game engine for a very popular video game called Grand Theft Auto 5. Which I guess is just kind of common currency amongst, you know, young people, gamers, like worldwide at the moment. So it's a kind of very recognizable visual language. The way they repurposed it was to create a very kind of meditative, sprawling film in which this narrative that they constructed was relayed over footage of these two avatars that loosely resembled them. They aren't directly them, but they loosely resemble them, walking through these kind of vast vistas, these kind of sublime landscapes, and just meditating on what becomes of identity in a sort of network society and what elements are at play to kind of fix identity and what capacities we have, I guess, implicit in that to kind of liberate identity and create conversation.
Right. I know this work is actually currently on display at the EVA International Festival as well in Ireland. And also, I think it's screening at the Tyneside Cinema in Newcastle. So if you want to catch it there, I think you can. But is it, as I read about it, it's parts one and two. Do you want to talk a little bit about those different aspects in the one and two?
I mean, the first part has a completely different sort of feel to it, and it looks totally different. It's got much more of a kind of a sort of like salvage punk slash steampunk aesthetic. This one specifically, I think I can't really sort of talk adequately about the distinction. I think I think the thing that really got me about it was that Grand Theft Auto is like a notoriously violent video game, And it's a game that courts controversy in, you know, mainstream kind of media platforms for some of the ludicrous things that it allows the player to do. And before I kind of put the article together, I interviewed David and Larry and just spoke to them very generally about why they'd chosen that game. And I told them I wouldn't kind of quote them directly in the article, which I haven't done. But there's this great quote that David sort of emailed to me. And it's just in relation to the way that death is figured in the virtual space. I was particularly interested in the way that you could repurpose something that was violent in order to create a sort of dialogue that kind of counteracts violence and creates a space of conversation. And this is David Blandy writing in an email to me, so I hope he doesn't mind me kind of quoting him. But he just writes quite casually. So the virtual space is a space without death. You die but respawn nearby. It's an inconvenience, a delay in progress, which makes me think of that KRS-One line on his Return of the Boom Bap. We will be here forever. Do you understand that? Forever. In a space with infinite time and no death, there's no way to eradicate difference, no way to ignore or fence it off. So you have to acknowledge difference, negotiate, have conversations, unfinished conversations through generations. And I just thought that was kind of like an amazingly poignant way of thinking about this as a space of dialogue.
Yeah, I mean, you talk a little bit about difference across different kinds of artists' work, from Angela Washko and also Anna Anthropy and some other artists as well, and how they're kind of foregrounding other kinds of spaces that have perhaps been withheld or kind of controlled, touching back upon your earlier points. Do you want to talk a bit about those kind of practices and how they interleave perhaps with David Blandy and Ashley Ampong? Go through that kind of space if you can.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the thing that kind of underscores this whole article is a sort of contemporary situation in which the gaming industry is an incredibly hermetic, closed space that's, I guess, most sort of adequately negotiated by white men, you know? They've kind of internalized a certain kind of power structure within the industry, and the industry itself is supported by player consumers who feel a sense of entitlement to a space online and police that accordingly. So one of the problems with that is that these kind of emergent spaces, as they're coming about, are quite kind of quickly and violently shut down by this kind of anonymous user base that don't really have a sense of accountability because they're kind of fugitive in a sense. So the thing that's
about the anonymity that kind of is underscores this sort of digital realm, really, and how that enables these kind of conditions to take place without the kind of recourse for perhaps more engaged identity situations or common space that perhaps wouldn't allow these things to take place.
Yeah, yeah, and I mean the thing that kind of really came out of this for me, there's a fantastic book by Anna Anthropy, who's a queer trans woman game developer based in the States, who wrote this fantastic book called Rise of the Video Game Zinesters. And the distinction that's really kind of vital there is that there's a kind of, a corporatized game production industry. And counter to that, there's a kind of indie scene which is able to utilize this democratized technology, this kind of production technology, to create games that have much broader scope in terms of the stories they tell and the experiences they allow their users to engage with. So Anna Anthropy's most famous work is called Dysphoria, and it's a kind of brightly coloured, very playable, brilliantly sounding, it's got this incredible soundtrack, rendition, or kind of like an empathic tool to kind of give you a sense of how she underwent hormone replacement therapy. Did you play it, by any chance?
I didn't. I played some of her other games. I played Gay Cats Go to the Weird, Weird Woods.
Okay.
And I also played the one that we illustrated, Queers in Love at the End of the World.
Okay.
I think because they were free, I'm sorry to say. Yes.
Well, I mean, this is kind of indicative of this whole trend, which, I mean, it's been written about very, very widely over the past few years, but it's what's loosely known as the Twine Revolution. And the Twine Revolution is basically, Twine is a kind of software that allows you to create scripts for kind of hypertext video games, and the most important practitioners in that kind of scene are, I guess, broadening the territory of what's discussed, and that like a kind of playable interface is something that raises very difficult questions about identity. So Porpentine is one of the kind of most sort of central figures.
Which you don't discuss, I think, in this particular feature, the Howling Dog's work, but it's similar in a way to the Anthropy. Yeah, I could see certainly the similarities between those two practices.
Yeah. But I think also, I mean, just to kind of like, I guess, diverge from that slightly on the idea of the interface, is one of the writers that I mentioned, Joseph Taylor, has this essay that was written for Eros Journal a year or so ago called Boy Islands. And in it, he's trying to talk about the way that these kind of virtual domains are these enclosed hermetic spaces that are policed by these normative identities. And the interface itself, which I guess is something that's kind of replicated in a lot of these films that I talk about, deliver a certain experience to the user. It's always a kind of heads-up display. You're kind of facing this open world, and it's an experience that's being delivered directly to you. And as a result of that, what I kind of loosely describe as this kind of user psychopathology is this sense of entitlement to a world that your identity can be kind of forced into and you can occupy. And I think there are all sorts of issues underscoring why these places are policed in the way that they are. And I think one of the most kind of vital arguments that I've read recently, and it's not one that I kind of fully understand, but I think it's worth making reference to, is by Willy Osterwile, who wrote this fantastic piece called Discipline and Pleasure for the New Inquiry on the relationship between depression and addiction. And he's talking about the kind of cyclical relationship between these two things, and how there's a kind of labor or time occupation at play in gaming that allows people to kind of defer recognition of their own depression. And I think with a lot of these kind of like geek communities, which I'm actively a part of in lots of ways, there is this sense that what you have, the space you have online, is something that's distinct from the space you have in like in meat space in real life. Is kind of sacred to you in a way that it's a space away from the pressures of like supposed social conformity. But the problem with that is that it kind of reconstitutes conformity, and it reconstitutes a kind of like a normative domain.
Well, yeah, you talk a little bit about Aidan Wall's work. I suppose that seems to chime there a little bit with his book, or his essay, Dos Souls, a dossier on speedruns, dossing and Dark Souls. And that image that we have of him sort of laid out, sprawled on a bed, sort of it captures that sort of isolated male white figure that's sort of behind a computer screen.
Yeah,
I think
yeah.
that sort of it sort of chimes with that.
The way I came across that actually was because the Irish artist Sam Keir put this post on Facebook that he'd photographed a copy of the zine that Aidan's essay kind of came in. With a copy of the game Dark Souls, and just wrote a comment that said something like, "That's it. I'm out of here for 2 months. My life is going to be pretty much buried in this game." So I just thought that kind of admission of like a certain investment was quite potent, and that's why I followed up Aidan's piece, which is a really fantastic film in its own right. It's just a kind of 5-minute video essay of him attempting to perform a speed run, which I kind of mentioned in the article. But a speed run is basically this kind of what Aidan characterises as like an unknowingly Taylorist approach to streamlining a game experience and really trying to kind of get out of, move out of the way the kind of like the element of free time and the sort of reverie of play and make it the most sort of linear and ridiculously kind of productive, cohesive experience. It's almost like non-enjoyable.
Right.
It's just kind of like doing something in the most Spartan, disciplined way from start to finish in the quickest time in order to kind of flex a certain sort of, performance muscle, whatever.
It's Yeah, it seems somewhat arcane to my mind, actually, as someone that doesn't game. However, I did find the work of Angela Washko sort of, it kind of captures or kind of counters that sort of isolation, the idea of those people that are behind these avatars, let's say, with the work, the Council on Gender Sensitivity and Behavioral Awareness in the World of Warcraft, which is an ongoing work from 2013, in which she sort of negotiates these kind of parameters through live streaming or live gaming. Do you want to talk a little bit about how that work actually operates and how it might be seen?
Yeah, no, totally. Yeah. And the thing that's really interesting about Angela Washko is that she's a, like a hardline gamer.
Yeah.
And her practice kind of emerges from this complete sort of immersion within these gaming worlds.
Yeah.
So There's a sense, I think, like I'm not a gamer. I'm definitely not a gamer in the sense that I really should be to be writing an article about this. But she, I guess, was aware that as a woman playing in a predominantly male environment, she would have to perform to a certain ability in order to get the attention of other players that she might want to interview. So her kind of gamer statistics, you know, her credentials are of a certain level that allowed her inner access to these spaces of a very popular online role-playing game called World of Warcraft. It's kind of, you know, fantasy, open world exploration game. And within that domain, she just asks a very simple question, which is what players' understanding of feminism is. And in some instances, this just creates the most inflammatory, like incendiary response. In others, it creates these really unusual, kind of evasive, coy responses that people, you know, they're sort of sensitive to the idea that they're being questioned about the way they're performing a certain role online. And there's a very good 20-minute video that she created called Playing as a Girl. I think that's the title, where she just tries to find female players who are playing as men, which doesn't happen that often within this particular game, within this milieu. But men are quite prone to playing as female characters and having a female avatar on the screen. And one of the things that comes out of this series of interviews is that a lot of male players would rather play as a female avatar because they feel that there's something intrinsically homoerotic to looking at a male avatar on screen. So there's this kind of insane sort of defensiveness that they think that, you know, playing as a male character renders them homosexual because they are objectifying a virtual rendition of a male body on screen.
Fascinating.
So there's all sorts of kind of intersecting insanities there in terms of the prejudices people hold and the way that those are kind of played out in terms of the adoption of an avatar and an online identity.
Craig, yes, that's something to think about. Anyhow, you talk a little bit about Haroon Farrokhi as well. I'm trying to think of...
go on, Naomi.
Oh, no, I was just thinking, is it a little bit like naming your boat after a woman? You know, is it the same thing?
Yeah, it could be, yeah. I guess there's definitely the same sort of like...
affection.
Yeah, I was going to say more like a kind of colonial agenda.
Ownership.
But you're like, and you're kind of pushing this thing out into the world. But... what I was just going to make a kind of quick point of drawing attention to was Daniel from Second Life, who I spoke to Angela Washko really briefly about this online, and she referred to him as a griefer. And I don't think griefers go down well with gamers, but he's basically a troll who makes these videos on YouTube, and they're really worth checking out, especially if you've read Deleuze's essay on Bartleby the Scrivener recently, because he's just this guy who just... refuses to perform, refuses to comply. It's like Bartleby's kind of I'd rather not. And the thing that's amazing about it is that if you perform that kind of non-compliance, this mild-mannered non-compliance in a lot of these kind of tense environments online, the first thing that happens is that people use homophobic, racist, and ableist slurs to kind of push you out of the group. And he's so good at doing this, and it's just something that really brings to the fore a lot of the underlying tensions of a lot of the communities that he's kind of moving within.
I mean, another writer that I was sort of, you talked a little bit about depression within the gaming industry, and there's that, I mean, you sort of touch upon that work by Zoe Quinn, the curator of Depression Quest. I was sort of interested in this other space that you talked about, ableism, just then, and which is an independent game exploring the limitations of care available for those suffering from depression. Is that a work? I mean, talk a little bit. Is that worth discussing in terms of this context? Do you think?
Totally. I mean, Zoe Quinn and another creator, not a game creator, but a journalist, Anita Sarkeesian, were core to something that's been known and become known as Gamergate. And this was basically a situation in which, I use the term like non-normative identities in the article and like scare quotes, but basically like anyone who isn't like a white male producing something within this gaming community with like a certain amount of visibility and professional kudos is, you know, open to all sorts of attacks. And these two women were like absolutely hounded as a result of the things they did. Anita Sarkeesian had a web series that's really worth checking out. I think it's really a really important work. in its own right, and it's called Tropes Versus Women. Mm-hmm. And it was her attempt to just explore the way that female bodies had been, I guess, subject to like this ridiculous male kind of fantasy honing in video game culture, and how that needed to change. And as a result of that, she was just called out online. People created videos against her. Somebody even created a game in which her body could be beaten. And Zoe Quinn is a game developer who created this game you mentioned called Depression Quest, mm-hmm. Which is a kind of text-based adventure on the limitations of care that are available to people suffering from depression. And as a result of creating that, a lot of her personal details, a lot of anecdotes from her personal life were kind of shared in this mm-hmm. really malicious manner. So they're really important. I guess they're really important creators, but they're also really important, I guess, like figures to just kind of, in terms of this period, this like really sort of transformative period of game culture to kind of keep in mind as we like proceed into the future. They're sort of remarkable.
Yeah, I mean, just closing a little bit, I mean, although it is returning, you actually draw in Haroon Faraki into the same, in a way, the same sort of discourse as The Boy's Island, actually. I thought it was quite an interesting, or unexpected, because I think of Haroon Faraki as quite an intelligent, engaging with this material. However,
yeah,
it was an interesting way of actually rethinking it.
Although this work, I thought, was a little bit myopic, I must admit.
Okay.
Yeah, and the reason it's myopic is because it doesn't allow for like the empathic projections of a gaming experience, which is kind of important.
We'll come back to that, I hope. But in the meantime, do check out Anna Entropy's work online. I do actually quite enjoy that. Okay, so moving on to Naomi Pierce and Martine Sim's work, which is still on display, I think, for a couple more days at the ICA. And the work, she's a San Francisco, LA-based Black American artist, and this is her first solo show in this country. Mm-hmm. Naomi, you went to see it and reviewed it for us. Mm-hmm. Just give us a quick outline as to what we might expect if we were to go see that show.
Okay. Well, I also wanted to talk about some of the things I didn't actually talk about in the review. So first of all, Fact and Trouble is the title of the show. And the title is taken from philosopher William James by way of Margaret Jefferson. And the phrase basically describes this idea of life being made up of a combination of facts and trouble. Or put another way, the troubling of reality. So I guess this like hangs in the background. And with this in mind, the exhibition examines the gap between lived experience and representation. And Martine does this in lots of different ways, but always kind of using photographs and moving image. And moving back and forth and overlapping personal and publicly sourced material. And something that someone she cites, Alison Landsberg, as kind of really influential is Alison Landsberg's concept of prosthetic memory.
Yeah.
Which again, I don't talk about in the review. Mostly, I think, actually, I mean, because Martine is really very articulate about her practice and I suppose I kind of wanted to try and depart a bit from her words, but I don't think I necessarily manage it. But because prosthetic memory is a really interesting term. So the idea that mass media has made available the conditions under which people might be able to attach themselves to past that may not be their own.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this nice phrase, privately felt public imagination.
Yeah.
So aside from, I guess, that kind of the look at this personal and public material and how they are kind of overlap or shape each other. There's also this questioning of the nature of authenticity and representation in the digital age and blackness as discourse. So Sims is really kind of keen to not define blackness, but rather think about the way that identities are constructed. So through kind of social, economic and legislative phenomena that formulate identity.
I mean, going into the gallery space, I mean, the first thing you see is sort of this corridor that's sort of embellished with what seemingly like posters. That's pasted to the walls, and mm-hmm. these images are both of her and also found images. Do you want to talk a little bit? Because these really are part of this idea of the prosthetic memory and how these two places are kind of interwoven.
Totally.
So there's this sort of shared psycho fantasy space away.
Yep, and all that. So that corridor is all taken. It's all material taken from this performative lecture, Misdirected Kiss, which she also did at the ICA a couple of days after the opening. So yeah, there's this combination of personal photographs, found images, stills from documentaries, and everything kind of sits together. It looks like the window of like a desktop, basically. Yeah. And this is actually what the performance ends up looking like at the end as well, this kind of collage that plays out in real time.
Yeah, I have to say, in a way, the posters, because I saw the work before the performance because of the way the show opened. And yeah, I mean, it was unclear as to, you know, which works were which, I suppose, or which were more personal, which ones were more found. I think actually having seen the performance, those kind of distinctions were much clearer. Obviously because because Martine Sims performed it and enabled that kind of access point to be reached. So that, I thought that was quite interesting and illuminating. Actually, it kind of illuminated the work a great deal, where you see Martine Sims with...
Tyra Banks.
Tyra Banks, the model.
Because that's the kind of one of the interesting photographs where these two spaces are like captured in the same. So there's like Tyra Banks with a 13-year-old Martine at the Tyra's T-Zone summer camp.
Yeah.
Which is all, I think, the camp's aimed at, you know, giving self-confidence and self-esteem to girls.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, did you find, though, then that the... You needed to know where these images were. You wanted to know where these images
No,
were
not necessarily. No, not at all. It created a different way of engaging with them in Tiny.
Because it's very, it's quite sexy, isn't it? That corridor. I don't know, I found like the corridor could, I was like, I don't know, it could be in Levi's or something. Like it looks...
It appropriates the sort of the seduction of what advertising imagery.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. Also, maybe because advertising in some... Yeah, I haven't really thought about this. I'm just thinking on the top of my head. But yeah, that advertising also kind of appropriates this like everyday, you know, familial language as well. It's not, you know...
It's definitely become more of a common vernacular, I guess, that idea of the everyday and how that's now sort of,
desirable.
So within that, then, the two sort of flanking rooms, there's one that actually features a quote of Zora Neale Hurston. Do you want to talk about how Martine Sims incorporates that within this installation and how that relates then to the video works that are then also in that room?
Yeah. So, the room to the left-hand side, when you walk in, has the slogan, lightly, slightly, politely, which is Zora Neale Hurston's, from her glossary of Harlem slang, and it translates to doing things perfectly.
Yeah.
And it's actually, so it's each word has a wall and, you know, the really big letters, and the font is designed by Martine as well.
Yeah, you talk a little bit about how that makes the room feel again. You sort of saw that, how that
gentrified.
Sort of, yeah.
No, it's just because it's something that I felt very, like, strongly, that there's, like, a strong aesthetic. Martine talks about having a graphic... you know, coming from graphic design. She also edits and, you know, writes for Dominica, which is her press.
Yeah.
So she's kind of multifaceted. And, I mean, the thing that's often bandied about is this conceptual entrepreneur that she coined for herself that people really kind of latch onto. It has this very kind of like stylized... Yeah. But also kind of minimalist. This room, in contrast to the corridor of images, is very minimal. And then in the centre, there are these two monitors which kind of float in the middle of the room, and they're playing the ongoing series Lessons, which is 30-second commercials for a black radical tradition. That's how Sims describes it. There are 68 on view in the ICA. I actually got it wrong in the review.
Oh, well, that's a corrective.
And this apparently will grow to 180. And Sims likens this to an incomplete poem. That's how she describes it.
Right.
Yeah, which is something, again, that I wanted to talk about in the review, but didn't actually make the cut, about poetry, as what poetry kind of gives her license to do, or whether this exhibition should be seen or read. Because images have such like kind of currency in it, and she talks about looking as knowing, which is something I thought actually maybe we might all want to come back to at the end, whether we believe that like looking was knowing. But I don't know, as a writer, that kind of makes me go like, is that true? What do I think about that? I don't know. I did want to talk about poetry a little bit. Can I go straight into that?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Okay. So she says that each of these 30-second segments, maybe I just describe that really briefly so that people who haven't seen the show, which you should definitely go and see, can get a sense of it. They're kind of 30-second commercials, and they're back-to-back on these monitors in the centre of the room. And you have to kind of circle. They flip between each monitor, so you have to like circle in this like looping motion around the monitors, and you're often missing them, and it's kind of like a frustrating experience intentionally. I think, you know, it's like channel surfing, I say in the review. And just a couple of like the kind of content so that I picked out: Blurred Gospel Singers, clips from home movies, self-help management workbooks, the Moesha soundtrack. So yeah, music is very important as well throughout kind of fragmented soundtracks. A fight in a bowling alley, cat gifs. So it's a very like broad kind of spectrum of images as well. So then these lessons, or you know, these, as she describes them, these 30-second segments are tied to a sentence. And I was thinking about this article by poet Quim Latimer, Art Hearts Poetry, which was published in Frieze magazine last year, where she reflects on the growing number of artists using the written word. Mm-hmm. And Latimer talks about this in relation to contemporary art's co-opting impulse. So a process not dissimilar to the machinations of capitalism, in the sense that they're both kind of devouring and assimilating everything. But something that I thought Latimer kind of like highlights, which I thought was interesting, was that poetry embodies the need to use language in a way that is not useful. And I thought that somehow this could be the same reason that like Sims is drawn to like looping images and kind of the repeat, which is something that kind of happens across the show in different ways. So not only the fact that she like uses her material again, as you say, like revisiting her past work and like reworking it, but also in the videos themselves, you know, the lessons themselves have these like repeats or these looping images. So this idea that kind of like poetry might, you know, kind of resist progress narratives, you know, that it might be a way of like using language in a way that, yeah, doesn't go anywhere, just like Sims tries to use images in a way that doesn't go anywhere. And perhaps that's kind of about trying to resist being productive.
Yeah, so it's, in a sense, it's sort of thwarting a narrative expectation, or even the sort of plot line of capitalism, I guess, is sort of deterred or kind of rolled around in a way that perhaps undoes or kind of allows anyway an analysis of that, perhaps.
Yeah, totally. And also just creating maybe another narrative that is not kind of an expected one, or a satisfying one. Yeah, maybe this thing about like not being satisfying is important.
I mean, it also, and then in the installation next door, she kind of conjures a sort of a white sort of, it's a sort of screening space or a kind with this series of props with further images attached to them. Do you want to describe this work?
Because I guess if like the room on the left is more about the representations, or especially in popular culture, then the room on the right I see more is kind of putting the, or Sims describes it as putting the conditions of production and viewing on display. Mm. So there's this, the work is called Belief Strategy, and it's these kind of like three sculptures. There's one other sculpture, but that's on the ground. And they're on this kind of photography studio platform, which has this white infinity sides, you know. And these sculptures are sea stand sculptures, which Sims describes as like the workhorse piece of equipment for photographers. But the stage also kind of keeps the viewer at a distance. So you see another, like this is another kind of flat plane that you look out to. So despite the sculpture, it is still looking at these things as images.
It's a sort of tableau.
Exactly.
In the same way, I guess you're referring to the desktop and so on.
And the stands are kind of really slickly painted in this purple, which is this recurring colour that Sims used. She has it on her website. And there's some like purple screens in between some of the lessons. And she talks about these as stands, or stands as figures. So they're kind of anthropomorphic, adopting poses and kind of like performing to some extent. And when how I guess I think about them is that there's this idea of like visibility and and invisibility that is at tension, I think, in a lot of the material that she's looking at. These kind of stands are a way of like, so she talks about being interested in kind of performance and posture and acting, because she's trying to counter invisibility with an extreme presence. That's what she kind of describes.
But in a sense, I would say the locus of that as well is specifically about black identity as well, I would thought. Or are you more sort of...
What do you mean about having being present?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And because those images, I would have thought as well, I mean, it makes me think about how a black body or face is lit and how those are read within the kind of confines of, say, technological development, We saw a talk recently about Ritsana Bradley, where she was saying how even technology itself is intrinsically, you know, forms of point of racism in the, you know, facial recognition technology and software, or even the history of makeup, you know, and so on and so forth, and how they've, you know, how that relates to black skin and so on. So, yeah, I mean, I think that work touches on those kind of mediation of those kind of skins.
Yeah, totally. But this thing, but... what I think is interesting is it's not as simple as just being invisible. There's this thing about being kind of like moving between invisibility and visibility, like just being highly visible in some ways and completely invisible in others. And Citizen, an American lyric by Claudia Rankine, is a book that Martine talks about, and she directly kind of deals, like talks about the kind of exhaustion of racism and how... Her quote is, "The daily grind of being rendered invisible or being attacked, whether physically or verbally, for being visible wears a body down." So this thing about being like rendered invisible in one hand and then also being like attacked, and how that takes its toll physically. And like there's something about the loop and the repetition. There's also, I know that Martine said about it being kind of this exhaustion.
Let's talk a little bit, because the performance as well, I think what was so notable about Martine Sims' performance as well was, and it's kind of sad, it was actually, she has a kind of very a light touch, I think. And
she's funny.
Yeah. And she's, so it's you encounter all this very, you know, this subject matter, but it's done in a very light touch. And it's also, I mean, I suppose it conjured that sense of the LA lifestyle in many ways, to my mind.
Relaxed.
And, yeah. Like her whole approach to it, you know, and as she kind of even parodied the kind of TED talk,
the power poses. Yeah.
And so on. You know, they were done with such kind of, humour, as you said. Yeah.
I mean, she's very charming, but the charm school is something. So, you know, on that, on the mystery, on the collage wall, there's Maxine Powell, who was the head of the Motown Finishing School. And, you know, she described her work as civil rights work, because it was about, like, uplifting race, like, giving these Motown singers class so they could perform to the king and queen.
Yeah.
And, you know, I know we were talking at the pub the other night with a friend, and they found that, like, they were unsure, like, what they thought about that as, like, whether that was a good, you know, like, whether a class school, you know, a finishing school was a good thing to be talking about. And, or, like, how did Martine relate to, where did she stand on this thing? And she's presenting all this material, but it's very, like... her position isn't necessarily clear. But then I've been thinking about that and thinking, like, is it her duty to be clear?
I would actually say no. And also, there is a sense of her position through the process of selection, and the even just the determination of what is shown and how she's choosing to show it is in effect an agency of its own.
Yeah, I think it's always questioning. And I think... you know, there's that thing about you can't really judge the past's decisions on, like, contemporary views on, you know, like, we all stand on other people's shoulders, you know. Yeah, same things have been said, I guess, about the different waves of feminism, for want of a better word, and how different generations have dealt with.
I think also formally as well, the way she was presenting the work, which is just, like, you know, allowing each wind...
Yes.
To those that haven't seen it, it's a performance where there's a projection behind her and she opens one image or one window and then she continually stacks images on
top.
So, you know, there's no sense of anything's being closed. Everything's just being continually opened.
Yeah, and I was just thinking, like, about that stacking as a kind of collapse, like, or just, like, just to stack in the hope that, like, eventually it will just all, like, kind of implode in on itself. And not that there'd be, like, some neutral ground, but or there'd just be, like, a zero again, like a mulch. That will, like, something new will come out of. Don't know.
Well, maybe we'll just draw a line for the moment then, Naomi. Maybe we can come back to that. But in the meantime, do go and see Martine Simjo at the ICA while you can. Moving on to Adam Pugh, who is was at the Oberhausen Film Festival earlier in May. We're in June now.
Yeah.
And for those that don't know, Oberhausen is a film festival. This is the 62nd iteration of that. And the theme of this particular iteration was El Pueblo. Do you want to talk a little bit about the curation of this the festival, and a little bit about the history of the Oberhausen Film Festival as well, for people that maybe don't know.
Yeah, I think it helps to put it in context. Yeah. because, yeah, it's a film festival. It's not, it stands out here, I guess, in what we're talking about, and that it's rather more straight. It's not, yeah. It's not the, you know, it definitely plays to the visual arts arena, and I think it's very interesting in that it has traditionally, and for a long time now, worked with curators, visual arts curators, alongside very, very, very Catholically, alongside kind of film industry people. But what's unique about the festival, apart from its age, I mean, it's this big kind of post-war edifice in a way, is that the space, the kind of conceptual space and physical space it gives to a large series of programs, a thematic series of programs, which every year the organizers of the festival ask an independent curator to come in and lead. And I think it's, you know, reasonably fluid. I think they're allowed to have a lot of freedom. And to be given this kind of space in which to gradually unravel an idea over, you know, 8 or 9 or 10 film programs, especially in the context of a film festival where most, if not all, film festivals would balk at the idea of this kind of this heart of the festival being given over to this kind of propositional way of thinking about how you program films, is in itself unusual. Mm-hmm. But I think it, you know, it's what, one of the things that makes the festival really special. I should point out it does deal with many of the kind of the normal structures of other film festivals. There's a large competition. There's a kind of market of sorts, but it's very much not about that. And there are kind of meeting points, discursive sessions, and various other things that help to unpick things. But this, the theme very much sits at the heart of it. And this year, it was El Pueblo, curated by a Buenos Aires-based curator, Federico Windhausen. And it was immediately interesting to me. I think I've been going for years and years, and it was interesting first off because it had a kind of very obvious connection to something very concrete. It was, mm-hmm. It allowed a way into the political in a way that their theme programs haven't in recent years. They've tended towards the self-reflexive and the theoretical, I suppose, the conceptual, which has sometimes worked and sometimes not. And I think it was refreshing to see them coming at something that actually could be unpicked and could be looked at from various different angles. So this theme was structured around this concept, which was alien to me, I have to say, of El Pueblo, which means the village. Mm-hmm. And across Spanish-speaking Latin America, that is, not in Brazil, they didn't have an equivalent for the phrase as such, but across Spanish-speaking Latin America, this term is understood in this very kind of amorphous and organic way, to mean everything from the village itself as a physical entity to the people, the kind of common voice of the people and the nation state and various levels in between. So it's this real kind of portable term which can get used and abused, I guess. Yeah. And what the theme set out to do was to look at various ideas about what this could represent and what it could have represented and what it could come to represent. At least that was its setup, and it was very much open from the start about this, the fact that any such term is, as well as being inclusionary, it's also necessarily exclusionary. Mm. So it wanted to set out to find out, you know, where is the without? You know, it's all very well talking about the within and who's in, but where is the without? And over several programs that themselves were sort of sub-themed around the city, around the idea of storytelling, ritual, performance, various other things, ethnography as well, it set out to kind of unravel this. But I mean, there are many good things about the program, the set of programs, not least some of the films, especially the archival works. And the curator himself, I mean, the setup of the festival is such that it's very discursive across the series of thematic programs. The idea is that the curator is there, so it's very different. I mean, interesting, I suppose, to a gallery presentation, because of course in a cinema you're there, you're captive, and this is much more of a show, and the curator will come and explain themselves really, and then there's always a Q&A afterwards, which is very helpful. But and this particular curator, Windhausen, was very eloquent. He was very personable. He was obviously at ease with his materials, and that was commendable, and as some of the material, much of the material was, but it unfortunately started to unravel as I wrote in my review, kind of midway along, really, where it, ironically, it kind of, it did just what it had set out not to do. It confirmed this kind of, this logic of exclusion, and also it became very gendered as well. And in a particular discussion session, which was aside from the films, composed entirely of men on the panel, it was challenged by a woman in the audience at some point, and it's, you know, who said, you know, just yeah. It's just interesting to point out that this is why have we got this all male panel? And it kind of completely fell apart. They just couldn't respond to it. It was very interesting. And from that came various other kind of worms that started eating the theme, not least that of the voice of the indigenous peoples, which really kind of deflated the whole thing, because mm-hmm. it became clear that it wasn't going to be addressed. This kind of elephant in the room, the indigenous peoples of Latin America, really didn't get much of a look in, unless they were kind of mediated by somebody else, by the voice of somebody else.
All right, so the invited guests that there were, who were discussing the work, weren't actually the filmmakers themselves, or were they just commentators, etc.?
Yeah, they were academics, mainly, and they had much to say, it seemed, although it kind of fizzled out, and none of them could kind of grapple with this very mm-hmm. Innocent but timely question about this kind of gendered thing that kind of coloured the whole of the programme in some sense. But that kind of led me to think, and I think other people that I was talking to at the same time, it led us to think about the fact that, yeah, that they're also, more importantly, in a sense, there wasn't the voice of the... It was constantly circling the other, but the other's voice wasn't there.
Yeah, often, I mean, that really is a problem where there is these groups, and maybe even we're implicated in that, I have to say at this very moment, where we're speaking on behalf of, and that does create a sort of complicated, well, to some extent, a complicated engagement, or one that, let's say, we should be aware of, at least... I think you're right in pointing out. But in which case, should we talk actually about some of the works that you did view and maybe some of those and how they stood up, really? Should we start with the first film you talk about, which is from the Paraguayan filmmaker Federico Adorno, and the work is La Estancia from 2014, and which sort of centres on the Caraguati massacre. Do you want to talk a little bit about what the film was?
Yeah, I mean, very briefly, because I haven't had recourse to it since.
Right. So it's kind of locked in my memory. Yes, that's fair enough.
And no, it was interesting that it was very formal, very still and quiet, and seemed to take the form of tableau that the filmmaker had arranged people in space effectively. And at first, it seemed like it might be a bit awkward. That, you know, was this was this kind of puppeteering? But I don't think it was. It was within the context of this program, which was the first program, which was the kind of setup of the theme, and introducing us, I suppose, to this concept of El Pueblo and all of the possible things that it might mean. It was interesting that way. It was also in terms of the way it dealt with land and these people's, these kind of, the actors, I suppose, relationship with that land. There's a lot of space in it, a lot of silence, and basically it took the form of the tableaus where people, I think, revisited sites of this massacre and around this massacre, but were silent and were placed in space, often in a way to suggest violence, or to require that we kind of revisit this scene of violence in some sense, but it was never really spoken. And so I think this kind of this leaving these grey areas helped.
Well, looking at actually what your review sort of touches on, I mean, Vindhausen, I mean, it is admirable for showcasing numerous works that I'm not familiar with. I mean, maybe that's also because these aren't particularly common to an art crowd. So that is an interesting sort of rub, I would have thought, or kind of tension, or sort of thing that would be taking place in the auditorium, where these films are being witnessed or seen by, maybe more of an art crowd. How did that, was that palpable, that sense of this different kind of crowd in there, or is that?
Yeah, usually because. I mean, there is the art crowd is there, and that's the interesting thing about it. And certainly from the UK, I think the people that come to the festival from elsewhere, there is the art crowd from other countries as well, but it's more mixed. There's not so many film people going from Britain. It's more the visual arts crowd. So in that sense, it was interesting, I think, because, as I said at the start, that several of the theme programs in recent years have been very much more playing to that, I suppose. And so it was this kind of sense of lassitude slightly, you know, that we'd seen it all before. And this was eye-opening in that sense, especially some of the historical works. There was one in particular, Brasilia, Contradictions of a New City, which was incredible, both in itself as a document, and I think I mentioned this in my review.
Yeah.
Both in the sense of a document, it was commissioned by the Olivetti Company as a film as a promotional film, effectively, to publicise Oscar Niemeyer's grand modernist project in the centre of Brazil. And it was the filmmaker basically didn't toe the line, it turned out, and the film was censored so much that it wasn't showable. And I think having the sense that this film was never going to be seen again, it turned out that much later, I mean, very recently, it was only discovered recently, apparently, that the filmmaker had stowed it in the archives in, I think, Rio, not to be seen until the early 2000s. And everyone thought this film had been lost, so he'd managed to kind of save it, in a sense. But the really incredible thing about the film, apart from this post-history of it, I guess, is that you can almost get the sense of the filmmaker changing his mind halfway through. It starts out as this very straight, here's Niemeyer's City, and this is what it's, starting out to do. It's about this kind of, this vertical city. It's very much this kind of grand modernist project. And then it kind of loses its faith in itself halfway through and starts veering off. And it becomes this kind of really politicised document about the workers who built the city, and the fact that, first of all, the plan was completely blown because the city didn't work even before it was built. So it started kind of becoming a horizontal city rather than a vertical city. It didn't keep within its borders. But also that they were treated really badly. There was also kind of labour abuses, union busting going on. And as soon as they'd done their bit, they were shipped out and treated appallingly. And as a result, all these slums grew up around the outside of Brasilia. And so, yeah, it was incredible seeing this shift in kind of real time over the 20 minutes or whatever of the film. This filmmaker almost losing his faith and becoming politicised. And then this consequent history of the film being kind of interred in the archive.
And did the curator, Winhausen, did he actually, you mentioned that, these sort of the Q&As and so on, did he actually ever explain why perhaps some of those filmmakers weren't invited or they weren't included? Was that ever touched upon in terms of, the actual general discussion through the festival?
Yeah, it was, and that was particularly problematic for me. I mean, as I said, this discussion session was difficult anyway, and it didn't really unpick anything. I mean, this is the frustration that I think generally a lot of the time at these kinds of events, even at Oberhausen, which is very generous in this space, it gives over to discursive activity, is that, you arrive with questions, you've sat through three programmes or whatever, and remember, of course, it's not, as I keep on saying, it's not the same as a gallery show. You can't go back in and see it again. You've got to see it. It's there. It's over. And you amass this kind of these images in your head, and then you want to go through to the discussion session and really engage and really drill down in the theme, and all too often it kind of dissipates. But as I mentioned before, I mean, the real crime, if there was one, was setting it up to talk about the other, essentially, to talk about giving room to those that are excluded, and to really unpick what it means to have this kind of exclusionary logic, only for it to completely renege on that, effectively. There was one program that was called Against Ethnography, and it opens with a film, A Arca dos Zoe, which was about the member of a tribe that had contact from the West, or from the conquistadors, I suppose you could call them. He had contact 20 years ago, so they were relatively kind of open. And it opens with him in a plane going to, it turns out, meet a tribe that's had very little contact, hardly at all. And it's about their conversation. And so it's this kind of meeting of minds. They talk about the difference in their customs and rites and rituals and just the way that they live. But it turns out that this is all kind of, this is completely mediated. In a way, it's a complete nonsense as a document, and it exactly is ethnographic because it was made by these Western filmmakers. And the point at which the kind of curatorial setup for all of this really gave way, apart from the content of the programme, which seemed to go against what it was trying to establish, was when the curator was quizzed about this. Not this particular film, but it's just in general about this the lack of the voice of the other. And he basically said, well, I did consider that. I wanted to include some material from Indigenous peoples, but it was too long and it would have unbalanced the programmes. And obviously...
It just sounds somewhat astounding, it's sort of this curatorial short-sightedness to the project, especially considering... The Oberhausen Film Festival is, you know, so expensive. I mean, it takes place over several days. I mean, it's not, it's not an afternoon, you know.
No.
And equally, the kind of people that do turn up to this event are pretty much hardened film watchers, I think. You know, it's a sort of pilgrimage of many. Maybe we start drawing up some conclusions here as we've only got a few minutes left. Does anyone have any further points or thoughts to make in reference to that? Or I know... Naomi, you wanted to raise the subject of knowing and thinking.
I was more putting it to my co-panelists.
Well, I thought you might have developed some thoughts over the last hour.
No development.
No.
No, just whether, looking was knowing, if that was adequate, or if that, how people felt about that statement.
I think it's something just to sort of ponder, I think. I can't really...
I'm sure Jamie has a thought about it. Come on, Jamie.
Not one, no.
Nothing.
No. I'm just like, intrinsically sort of sceptical of like any kind of objective approach in a way. Like I think like, that's an incredibly like complex relationship between the relationship between looking and knowing presupposes like a kind of sovereignty of the gaze or something. Do you know what I mean? It's like, I know what I know because I'm kind of predisposed to a certain subject position. That would be like my kind of, tidbit.
Truly, only living is knowing, really. I mean,
I just think there's endless limitations.
No, but I guess it's just more like, I suppose I just understood the statement as more that was enough, just to look as this kind of that's having enough of a kind of effect on how we think about things. Just seeing these images, not even processing them or engaging with them, and that's a dangerous thing. In living in a world of over saturation of images, that could be potentially a kind of scary thought. Like
subliminal.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay, I'll just leave you to say a great thank you to our guests this evening. That's Adam Pugh, Naomi Pierce, and Jamie Sutcliffe. I'm Chris McCormack, and this is the Art Monthly Talk Show. If you do want to submit text or anything to the magazine, do email me. It's chris@artmonthly.co.uk. Many thanks again for listening, and many thanks again to my attending guests.
Thank you.
Thanks.